From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. During a recent visit to Charlotte, a former high-profile federal prosecutor raised questions about the contrasting federal investigations involving Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. You'll hear his concerns. State lawmakers are considering changing the way North Carolina selects its judges. You'll learn details of one of their proposals. A task force studying school funding in North Carolina might focus on increased flexibility for local school systems. You'll hear reaction from the John Locke Foundation's top education expert. And we'll discuss recent high-profile discussions about hospital mergers in the Tar Heel State. Will consumers benefit if these mergers go forward? Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
They were horrific tragedies, the deaths of North Carolina corrections officers, public servants who died at the hands of prison inmates. Their deaths in the continuing challenge to staff North Carolina prisons have shined the light on a system with very serious needs. In fact, it is the cover story of the February issue of Carolina Journal. Carrie Travis is associate editor of Carolina Journal, and she is the reporter who's bringing us this story. Carrie, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Donna.
So following the killings of these corrections officers in Bertie County, Pascotake County, the scrutiny really came fast and furious. Take the story from there.
Yeah. So the Department of Public Safety was already reviewing operations at its prisons. Secretary Hooks had already requested that people look at how the budget was being spent across the board, how prisons were being managed. And then he kind of got handed this huge set of tragedies during his first year. And from there, he commissioned a couple of additional studies, one from the National Institute for Corrections, which looked at the Pasquotank incident and everything that happened there, one from the Governor's Crime Commission and Duke University researchers. And his goal was not only to identify the specificities of what happened at Pasquotank, but also to look at what was wrong in the prison system in general. Because as you mentioned, we had the Bertie incident that was also very tragic. Sergeant Megan Callahan was beaten to death with a fire extinguisher. And so what all these reports brought in was an awareness that we have had these problems for years and we're just kind of having a media wake-up call. What should we do about it?
Before we get into the specifics of what those studies found and what the legislature is starting to look at, give us a sense of the type of money we're talking here for North Carolina's prison system and the number of inmates we're talking about.
Yeah. So the overall budget for the Department of Public Safety is about $2 billion. Of that $2 billion, about $1.2 billion is spent on prisons. Just under a billion goes to salaries, to benefits, basically all of those, you know, compensations for officers, for staffers, that type of thing. We have about 37,000 inmates in our prison system. We have 55 prisons, about 37,000 inmates, and many of those inmates, we don't even have an exact number, have mental health issues, which, as you alluded to earlier, is one of the many issues that we're struggling to solve right now.
Indeed, there's so many different angles to this story. Let's start first with the challenge that state officials have to even recruit people into North Carolina's prisons to be corrections officers. You mentioned money going to salaries. Some people say it's a salary problem. You have to pay people more. Other people say this is simply a job that a whole lot of people don't want to take because, frankly, it's not glamorous and it can be dangerous.
And the fact is both are true. It is not glamorous. And we're looking at many prisons that are in rural areas, many high security prisons that are in rural areas. We have situations where officers, corrections officers, staffers are traveling an average of an hour a day just to get to and from work, sometimes more. Would you work for $35,000 as your top number in an institution where you're on the road for an hour and a half a day and you don't know if you're going to come home and see your family again? And those are the types of challenges that we're dealing with in terms of recruiting. The numbers are compelling. We had a 16% understaffing in prisons last year, up from 9% the previous year.
And I know, Carrie, that in some of your reporting, there have even been instances because of this difficulty in hiring people where you have people who have accepted the job and they are on the job and they still haven't had some of their basic training.
Absolutely.
I mean, that is scary. That's scary for them. It's scary for the inmates. It's scary for those of us who are paying for all of this.
Absolutely. And you have to wonder, the number that was thrown out, Secretary Hooks presenting before the legislature, a committee at the legislature a few weeks ago, said that there were as many as 700 officers who were on the job for months last year without their basic training, which is roughly a three-week program. And so what they had to do is go back, identify all of the officers that hadn't received even that basic training, and then make time over the course of very few months to make sure that they had all of the information that they needed. You have instances like the one in Pasquotank where the understaffing is so poor, one officer was assigned to oversee about 30 inmates in a sewing plant where they had access to scissors, sharp objects, and then you see what happened there, the horrific tragedy, four officers killed. And so you have this problem of understaffing, you have lack of training, this sense of uncoordinated efforts. I think the Department of Public Safety is at a point where they very much want to make changes. The question is, how do we do that efficiently? How do we do that safely? And even what are the extent of the problems that are the worst issues to address first?
Carrie, in your reporting, and again, it's the cover story of the February issue of Carolina Journal, you talk about problems on almost the other side of the house, so mm-hmm. to speak, in the prison system. That involves the inmates themselves. Mm-hmm. A lot of mental health issues, a lot of drug addiction.
Yes.
So what do we do about that?
No, that's a great question. That's a great question, Donna. And I think that's one of the things that people are struggling with right now.
Legislators trying to look at that and come up with some sort of solution.
It comes back to money. You know, you have the largest percentage of de facto mental health providers are in the prison system, but you don't have enough to care for prisoners. And there aren't enough social workers either. I spoke with some folks over at NC Disability Rights, and they told me that caseworkers to care for mental health, you know, prisoners with mental health issues are overloaded. They don't have time. Doctors are scarce. There was an incident we talked about in the front page story of a prisoner who was locked in solitary confinement for weeks without his medication, his water turned off. He was a schizophrenic, a veteran of the United States Army. We have these issues. How do we provide mental health care? How do we find the money in the budget to take care of this issue? And where do we put those programs in place?
The other thing that's fascinating about this whole story, Carrie, is that it seems to have gotten the attention across the political and mm-hmm. ideological spectrum. Mm-hmm. You have talked with folks at the ACLU. You've mm-hmm. talked with folks who are very conservative, who mm-hmm. wouldn't normally align with the ACLU mm-hmm. on an issue. But does that mean that there really is more momentum to try to sit down and hammer out what is clearly really, really challenging stuff?
Yes, absolutely. The Trump administration took up a roundtable discussion about this just a little over a month ago, I think it was, gathered members of all political factions and viewpoints in one room, and the general consensus is that we need more rehabilitation for prisoners. Losing your freedom is punishment. It is the task of prisons to retrain and, you know, basically turn into productive citizens, these members of society that have fallen out of step. And that's what we're facing. I think there's bipartisan support across the board for that.
We've been talking with Carrie Travis. She is associate editor of Carolina Journal. And Carrie has written a really comprehensive, great piece. It's the cover story of the February issue of Carolina Journal. Carrie, it's a great piece. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. It's a tale of two federal investigations. They involve the most recent Democratic and Republican candidates for president. Andrew McCarthy of National Review is a former federal prosecutor. He says the cases have been handled very differently. He explained how during a recent speech in Charlotte for a joint John Locke Foundation and National Review audience. He joins us now with more details. How are these cases different?
We're seeing two different situations inescapably because one of them was a very public criminal investigation. Even though it involved classified information and emails, it was essentially a criminal investigation, so it was handled in a different way, whereas the current investigation that's being looked at involving President Trump and Russia is a counterintelligence investigation that has a criminal aspect to it. So the nature of the investigations is different, and in that way they were unavoidably different. But I think objectively, any person who looks at the way these two things were handled has to say that Mrs. Clinton got the kid gloves treatment and the Mueller investigation and its predecessor Russian investigation, they're sort of scorching the earth to make a case.
What should people without a law enforcement background know about the differences?
The easiest thing for people to lay their eyes on and see is that in the Mueller investigation, what we see is that when you lie to the FBI, you actually get prosecuted, which is the way it works in 99.9% of cases that don't involve Clintons, right? In the Clinton investigation, if you lied to the FBI, it was like Thursday, you know. Basically, what they did was whenever anybody got close to providing incriminating information, they either gave them immunity or they cut a deal with them. They prevented the agents from asking key, obvious questions. And I think the whole thing, the more we look at it, appears to be a situation where what they essentially did was try to stage something that looked like a thoroughgoing investigation at the end of the rainbow, of which was she was going to be exonerated, which was politically very important.
Why should this concern us?
Well, because we want everybody to have the same standard of justice. The rule of law and the reason that we can have ordered liberty in the society is because we believe that the results that come out of the criminal justice system have integrity. And the reason we think they have integrity is because everybody gets treated the same. Every person, whether he's the president or the lowliest person, is supposed to be equal, not only before the bar of justice, but also how they are regarded by the federal and the other police and intelligence agencies. And when we see that, you know, if you're one particular stripe of person, you get one quality of justice, and that everybody else gets a quite different quality of justice, I think that's very alarming to people. And it should be.
We're chatting with former federal prosecutor Andrew McCarthy. He writes now for National Review. Has the Mueller investigation proceeded as you would expect?
I think there's a lot of noise around that investigation, and it's to someone like me, it's more important to, you know, tell me what he's done. Show me the charges. And so far, I think people can take confidence that even if the investigation has been very aggressive, and even though he's gotten a stable of people, which I think is far beyond what you would think one would need to do the investigation he's doing, if you look at the charges he's brought, they're all justifiable and they make sense. I don't think that can be said about the first investigation, where there appears to have been a mountain of evidence and that they basically contorted themselves to avoid bringing charges, including not prosecuting people who clearly lied to the government, giving immunity to people who should have been squeezed for cooperation, and contorting criminal statutes, really distorting them to avoid applying them as they're written to people like Mrs. Clinton, who seem to have had culpability under them.
With federal law enforcement agencies under such scrutiny, is there an opportunity to make some positive changes?
We have to look at it. And the main reason we have to look at it, not just for the public reputation of how our federal law enforcement agencies conduct themselves, but there's a real strong national security angle to this. And good national security intelligence collection and enforcement is really reliant on the idea that the public can trust the agencies, because so much of it is in this black box of classified information. And so much of it really is about a need to protect sources of information and methods of gathering intelligence, that in many ways they really have to tell you, trust us. And we have to be able to trust them, because they're not just out there trying to make cases. They're actually out there trying to protect the country from people who are trying to do harm to Americans. So it's important that we have some transparency, and it's important that we get our agencies to a point where most Americans, when they say trust us, they think they're worth trusting.
How important is it to fix whatever problems exist within these agencies?
It's extraordinarily important, because people don't have a historical enough perspective of this. I'm an older guy now than I was when I started as a prosecutor many years ago, so I still remember what crime was like in this country in the 60s and 70s when I was growing up. And I think a lot of people don't have that historical perspective anymore. So we've had a generation of record low crime. And I think when you assume that as your everyday reality, you forget how hard it was to get to that point, how we had to go from high crime to what we have now. And really that was on the basis of, number one, superb performance by our law enforcement and to some extent our intelligence agencies, but also our ability to trust them that they were doing what we need them to do. And we can't, as you see the prosperity that we have in the country, we've had record prosperity at the same time we've had record low crime. They go hand in hand. So when the enforcement piece of it breaks down, you have to worry about the prosperity piece of it breaking down. So it's extraordinarily important.
What should people be watching for?
Of course, the most important thing on the enforcement side and with respect to Special Counsel Mueller is what charges we see. I think that they've now been investigating the Russian collusion angle of this for about 2 years. And from everything we can tell, at least publicly, and there's been a lot of leaking, so we know a lot more probably than we should. It sure looks to me like whatever they may have in terms of troubling stuff about President Trump or his campaign, it certainly doesn't rise to the level of a conspiracy to commit espionage or some other actionable offense. And I think because of the importance of or the detriment to the country of a situation where the president tries to govern with a cloud over his head, I think at the very least, if that's a dry hole, if they don't have a collusion case, they ought to come out and say, we don't have a collusion case. That doesn't preclude them from continuing to look at obstruction. I personally don't think legally what we have here comes close to obstruction. But, you know, I could be wrong, right? So there's no reason why that thread can't be continued. But, you know, this whole idea of having a president for over a year govern with a suggestion out there that he was involved in a sinister, corrupt conspiracy with an adversary regime. If that cloud can be lifted, it ought to be lifted. It's better for it's not for President Trump, it's better for the country.
That's Andrew McCarthy of National Review, a former federal prosecutor, discussing Hillary Clinton, President Trump, and federal investigations. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal Radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. State lawmakers are considering possible changes in the way North Carolina selects judges. Judges are elected now, but there's been talk about changing to a merit selection process. Republican Senator Paul Newton explains why.
We are all looking for the best plan. So we've heard a lot of ideas, a lot of approaches to selecting highly qualified judges, and the purpose is let's find the best model for North Carolina. So this is a balance between independence and accountability. Independence, for those who haven't been seeped in these issues, means making sure our judges are independent from undue influence from executive legislative branches and arguably too frequent campaigning and donors. So we need to make sure our judges have independence to rule the way they see fit. Independence is not equal to illegitimacy, which could occur if the pendulum were buried on independence instead of being balanced with accountability. And the accountability at bottom is to the citizens of North Carolina to interpret laws as intended by the Constitution. So we need to make sure there is some level of accountability for judges, all the while ensuring their independence along the way. But accountability, like independence, can't be so extreme that it impinges on that independence.
Newton and his colleagues have outlined a plan that would have the state Supreme Court's Chief Justice set up a new 7 or 9-member group. It would screen potential judges and label them qualified or unqualified.
You'll see transparency. There'll be no mysteries. It won't be a backroom, smoke-filled room. It's going to be a transparent, independent merit selection process. The General Assembly will review qualified nominees submitted by the Independent Merit Selection Committee and forward at least 3 of those nominees that they consider best qualified to the governor. The governor, he or she, will review those qualified nominees submitted by the General Assembly and appoint the nominee that he or she considers the most qualified to serve the state.
Lots of questions remain unresolved. Questions about the screening group, questions about the term of office, questions about retention elections. Senator Bill Rabin responds to the questions.
These are the sorts of things we need your opinion and your recommendation on, and everyone else's recommendation. This is, you know, this is not the recipe. It's just a guideline. So that's what we would like, is the recommendations from other members of the committee. You know, how to improve step 4, step 3, step 5. How do we get through here? Or do we scrap the whole deal?
You've been listening to discussion of a plan to change the way North Carolina selects its judges. Any change would require a state constitutional amendment. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we do. And that's not bluster. In a private survey of more than 250 North Carolina political insiders, 87% said we influence them either a great deal or a good amount. So while others talk and complain, we get to work providing research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse that is the envy of every other state. Our research has actually helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, and improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. The John Locke Foundation, we're dedicated to making North Carolina first in freedom. We're dedicated to you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina lawmakers are considering major changes in the dollars and cents linked to the state's public education system. A joint legislative task force is focusing on education funding issues. But task force member Hugh Blackwell, a Republican state representative from Burke County, is looking beyond the numbers.
As I think about education, in my mind at least, it's not about being sure that we spend equal amounts of money on students. It's about being sure that students receive the education that they need to be successful, whatever that means, as an adult citizen and provider for themselves and their families and so forth.
Blackwell says he likes a proposal from a group called the Education Commission of the States. It would focus on an education funding formula with more flexibility and adaptability.
That would allow districts under a high-quality funding formula to have more flexibility to meet their unique needs, which I interpret to mean the unique needs for their students, and to be adaptable so that the state is not forcing programs and policies on them that prevent them from changing how we deliver services to the students that we're trying to educate.
Blackwell reminded colleagues that the answer will not be simple.
The problem that we run into is that when we give flexibility and adaptability to our districts, they don't always spend the money the way some people in Raleigh think they should. My inclination is to go with the flexibility and the adaptability, but at some point, When does the state say to a district, okay, we gave you these items, we did a high-quality funding formula, we maximized your ability to meet the unique needs of your students and to adapt the delivery systems, but you're not getting it done, so therefore we're going to do things differently. We're not going to have flexibility and adaptability to the same extent.
That's the voice of State Representative Hugh Blackwell, Republican from Burke County, speaking at a recent meeting of the new Joint Legislative Task Force on Education Funding. Joining us with some reaction to Blackwell's comments is Dr. Terry Stoops. He is the Vice President for Research and also the Director of Education Studies at the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back, Terry.
Thank you.
So first of all, as this meeting was underway and there was discussion about this number and that number, Hugh Blackwell said, wait a minute, you know, while we're talking about numbers, remember that the main point here is to come up with a system that is the that is best for educating our students. So he basically was asking his colleagues to remember it's not just about the numbers. How important is it to keep that in mind?
It's extremely important, and it's the one point that many people forget about is that this money is actually used for something, and we want to use it in the most productive way possible, get the most bang for our buck. And so when we think about the way that money is distributed, we need to think about issues like teacher quality and class size and administrator quality and all the things that, that money pays for that will increase student achievement. So I think he's right on target here.
And I get the sense, both from what he said and what from others have said, is that there is no magic number that if you spend X amount, everyone's going to be fine.
Yeah, that's right. And this is an important point to remember is that there isn't a specific dollar amount that they're going to be targeting and looking at making sure that every student meets a certain targeted dollar amount. All student needs are different. There are some students that will require extra services, and of course that will require extra money. So I think it's important to note that when we look at any type of funding system, that we have one that makes sure that it meets the needs of individual students.
One of the ideas that cropped up that Representative Blackwell responded to, we heard earlier in his comments, was this notion of having some type of funding formula that has increased flexibility at the local level and also adaptability so that you can change the formula on the fly when there are new developments and you don't just stick with this rigid formula that's hard to adapt. How important are those two factors, flexibility and adaptability?
Well, I think they're very important. And it's worth mentioning that it's really the school systems that know the students. The parents in the school systems that are closest to students know them best and are able to meet their needs with that knowledge. Right now, we have some flexibility available to our school systems, but probably not as much flexibility as they would like. And the legislators are really looking at how the money is given to school districts at this point and looking for ways to maybe school districts would have some flexibility for the money that they receive from the state. Other monies that they receive, such as from the federal government, there's very little flexibility in the use of that. So I know that school districts would treasure any sort of flexibility that the state could give them in providing the large, almost two-thirds of the funding of the budget that they receive every year.
Now, one caveat that Representative Blackwell also threw in at the end of his remarks was, okay, adaptability, flexibility sounds good. What happens when we make this change and then there are some school districts that just fall down on the job? Is the state going to go back and say, you failed and so you're going to lose your adaptability and flexibility? Is that something that has to be accounted for?
Well, one of the things that legislators need to look at are a clear set of expectations, measurable expectations for districts, so that you make the deal with them that if they're able to meet a certain type of standard, then they can use the money any way they see fit. If they're not able to meet those measurable benchmarks, then their flexibility is going to be decreased. And I think that that's probably the best and most appropriate way for them to set up a new funding system.
You've been following this process very closely. What, from your vantage point, is the best way for lawmakers to proceed as they're trying to tweak or completely overhaul their education funding formula?
I think it's important that they attach the funding to the students. Look at what the individual student needs, give a base amount to every student, and then look to see what various amounts could be added to that base that would benefit those students that may have special needs, that may be in gifted programs, that maybe are in career and technical programs. That's probably the best way that they can go about creating a program that's both transparent and provides accountability for the districts that receive the funds from the state.
I get the sense that no state has come up with a silver bullet of a program that works perfectly that everyone else should adapt. But is there another state or a group of states out there that are moving in the right direction that North Carolina ought to emulate?
Most recently, California has switched to a system of student-based funding, and I think that that is a good model for us to look at. And it is a difficult process, considering that a lot of states fund their public school system with property taxes, which is what we don't do here in North Carolina. And the fact that most of the funds come from the state gives us some kind of a unique opportunity here for us to create a system that might not look like what a lot of other states have, provide a funding system that allows the majority of funding to be attached to the student and allows districts the opportunity to use that funding in a flexible manner.
In the brief amount of time that we have left, do you get the sense that we will see some sort of major change based on the work of this task force?
I think we will see a major change, but I don't expect it all to be implemented at once. I think we're more likely to see a change that will be implemented over 2 or 3 years that would initially include a hold harmless provision for districts, allow them to get used to what this new funding system would look like after 2 or 3 years of implementation, and then make it a permanent system from there on out.
Dr. Terry Stoops is the Vice President for Research and Director of Education Studies at the John Locke Foundation. Terry, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Full color throughout every issue. More visual storytelling. We've revamped Carolina Journal to make it easier to read. A new look and a new feel. But one thing hasn't changed, and it never will. That is our commitment to truth and transparency in government. You can still count on Carolina Journal for investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, and vetting of corruption. No, our mission to shine the light on what North Carolina government and the bureaucrats who run it are doing in your name and with your money will never wane. And because of that, our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our distribution outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians every month. So make sure you stay informed. Read the monthly print edition of Carolina Journal. Then check in several times a day at carolinajournal.com. That's where you'll find fresh stories, opinion pieces, and updates on government, politics, and your money. Carolina Journal, we hold government accountable to you. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. It is being called a mega deal in North Carolina, the proposed merger of UNC Healthcare and Atrium Health, formerly known as Carolina's healthcare system. Now, if this deal does go through, North Carolina could be home to one of the largest hospital behemoths in the entire country. The question is, how might North Carolinians be impacted by this? What about care? What about costs? Catherine Restrepo has been looking into all of these questions. She, of course, the John Locke Foundation's Director of Healthcare Policy. Catherine, welcome back.
Thanks.
Now, this is an interesting story for a number of reasons, not just because this is two major companies looking at merging. UNC Healthcare is actually a state-owned entity, so every one of us has an interest in this story.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's a great point that you make. The public is asking for more transparency with this mega marriage that's happening between UNC and Carolina's Healthcare. But I would add that Carolina's Healthcare has since changed their name to Atrium Health because they've just announced that they'd like to merge with another hospital in Georgia. So they'd like to extend, you know, their name beyond just the Carolinas. It's going to be much more in a regional focus.
So it makes it even a more complicated story in some ways to figure out who is going where and all that. Give us a sense of these two systems. How many people are we talking about here?
Yes. Well, when you look at the mergers across, I mean, mergers is it's this increasing trend across the healthcare sector. You have more hospital consolidation, more provider consolidation. And when you look at UNC and Carolinas, I mean, combined, it would be a $14 billion operating budget, and they'd be overseeing over 90,000 employees and managing over 50 hospitals. So, I mean, if this merger, this partnership, that's technically what it's called, were to go through, I mean, this entity would be one of the largest hospital systems in the nation. I mean, Carolina's healthcare is already one of the largest in the nation itself.
Now, what they are saying is that this will be a really great deal for North Carolina. Mm-hmm. Essentially, what's their argument for the partnership?
And, you know, their reasoning behind this partnership is that they want to, you know, have more integrated care across the continuum of healthcare where patients get their care and the different levels of care they receive. You know, they're really looking to extend their care into more, you know, maybe have more satellite campuses in rural areas. Rural healthcare or rural access to care is a big issue now. Lawmakers are currently talking about that. And they'd also like to expand their reach for patients who need mental health services. So that's their, you know, that's their mission behind this proposal.
You've been looking into some research and data on mergers. What have you found?
Well, it's interesting because when you look at health, when you look at other parts of the economy outside of healthcare, mergers tend to increase efficiencies and lower prices for consumers for the products that those companies sell. But healthcare is different because it's so heavily regulated. So it's really not the mergers themselves. You know, a big question here is going to be about the cost. You know, in other sectors of the economy, like I said, you have lower prices when you see mergers generally. In healthcare, it's different. In fact, like when you look at the evidence from mergers across the country, you know, in the past 10 years or so, some healthcare cost prices have increased by as much as 40% for patients. And that's simply because when you have two large entities merging together, they have more leverage when they negotiate reimbursement rates with insurance companies. And so in order to bear that cost, insurance companies pass that along to consumers in the form of higher health insurance premiums.
Well, speaking of insurance companies, it's pretty interesting that Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina, the behemoth in the insurance industry in this state, they have publicly stated that they oppose this merger. What's their reason?
Yes, and it all goes back to healthcare costs. You know, their mission is to, you know, I mean, right now there's a coalition, the North Carolina Coalition of Fiscal Health, that's a part of Blue Cross and Blue Shield, and their campaign is to let's talk about healthcare costs. So that's, you know, a big part of their mission right now. How can we contain healthcare costs? And
so that seems to be two, like, differing points of view. You've got the two organizations looking to merge, and they're saying, hey, we will bring down costs. It'll be much more efficient. But the major insurance company is saying, no, we see it exactly opposite. Mm-hmm. Why would they see it as opposite? Mm-hmm.
And, well, that's, again, because when you have two large hospital systems, they have more negotiating power to get higher reimbursement rates. And so when you look at mergers themselves, it's really not – the mergers themselves isn't what's causing these higher prices for healthcare consumers. It's the fact that there's so many regulations in healthcare compared to other parts of the economy that are leading to higher prices. And it gives, you know, these large hospital systems the advantage of charging, you know, artificially higher rates because there's less competition. There's so many regulations in healthcare that prevent – competitors from entering the healthcare space, from competing against these big players, and it just allows the big players like Carolina's or Atrium Health to keep getting bigger.
Catherine, you write that one of those regulatory barriers that exists right here in North Carolina is called Certificate of Need.
Yes.
Just briefly explain to us what that is and how that keeps competition out.
Sure. I mean, certificate of need laws, it's if you want to ask, if you want to expand your business, say a hospital wants to expand a new wing for inpatient beds, or a hospital wants to get and purchase another MRI machine, or say that a group of providers, doctors want to band together and build their own surgery center. I mean, so many, a large percentage of surgeries can be performed on an outpatient basis now, and that's a continuing trend across the healthcare space,
too. That would be less costly than going to
a
big hospital.
Yes, right? When they're standalone, when they're independently run, the patients pay a lot less out of pocket compared to the same procedure being done in a full-service hospital. But what Certificate of Need does, it prevents those entities from competing or from expanding their businesses because how it works is that you have this body, this body of bureaucrats that really determine what is needed across the state for certain services. Like, how many MRI machines are needed. And they all calculate this based on population projections and volume percentage increases and all these other complex formulas, instead of just allowing the market to determine themselves and the risk that they want to take themselves to serve patients in a better, more efficient way.
Because you would think that if you are a group of doctors, you wouldn't be expanding your service in an area that you don't have a lot of data that shows you that you're going to have patients, you're going to have customers
right,
for this.
Yeah, so they're bearing that risk, and you would think that the communities themselves would know, or they're willing to take that risk to enhance patient care or offer lower cost services for their patients. But instead of the market determining what's in the best interest of their patients, the state has this centralized planning system, the certificate of need process, that tries to determine, you know, what are the necessary resources that should be equally distributed across the state as a way to contain healthcare costs, but in fact has produced the opposite results over time.
One of the really curious things about certificate of need that you have written about, and we may have discussed this on this show, is that when someone applies for the certificate that is required for them to be able to expand or add something, that the person who's actually in existence already, essentially their potential competition, can say, no, I don't want that person to be able to do that.
Yes, they can deny. They can write a petition saying, no, these surgeons don't, there is no need for another surgery center. You know, we already offer these services, and this would just add duplicative services or increase healthcare costs overall. So the certificate of need process itself, it's just one, it's probably the most severe example of barrier to entry into the healthcare space. And that just goes back to how when mergers happen, you know, it's easier. They have more leverage in negotiating high reimbursement rates from insurance companies, which ultimately increases the overall cost for patients.
We've been talking with Catherine Restrepo. She is the John Locke Foundation's Director of Healthcare Policy. Thank you, Catherine.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll come back next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.